You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Episode 193. Today's episode is all about a new book highlighting photography from the archives of the Historic New Orleans Collection. The last show was all about the mysterious drink known as absinthe. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. I think you'll enjoy it. Before we jump in, let me talk about the people that make this show possible, and one of them is where we're sitting today, the Historic New Orleans Collection, the city's premier history museum located at 520 Royal Street in the heart of the French Quarter. Check out their online publication called First Draft. It's a combination blog and exhibition space. You can find it at hnoc.org/firstdraft. Through November 5th, 2023, so we're running out of time, but you still have a few weeks to check out their exhibit about the women's right to vote. Titled Yet She Is Advancing, New Orleans Women and the Right to Vote, 1878 to 1970. We all know the 19th Amendment granted American women the right to vote, but in 1920, Louisiana laws effectively disenfranchised black women. As many white women began going to the polls and increasing their political participation in segregation-era New Orleans, African-American women continued to fight for access to the ballot. The exhibit tells a decade-long story through objects, images, documents, and interactive displays, and through the words of the New Orleans women who for nearly 100 years persisted in their struggle to vote. As always, the New Orleans collection is free. It somehow continues to fly under the radar, but it definitely ought to be on your stop for a visit, whether you're a local or you're visiting from out of town. Go to hnoc.org/visit to plan your trip. Our next sponsor is also sort of interesting given the topic of today's show. It's Accidental Cajun Photography. If you own a copy of the book Beyond Bourbon Street, Travel Guide, my book, you've seen the work of James Cullen of Accidental Cajun. Whether it's portraits, events, wedding, or lifestyle or photojournalism, Accidental Cajun Photography provides quality and value. James also offers photography instruction and sells his fine art prints at theaccidentalcajun.com. For inquiries, email him at accidentalcajun@gmail.com, and we'll put links to all that in the show notes. Now on to today's topic. My guest was the curator of the Historic New Orleans Photography Holdings for more than 40 years. He's released a book called Louisiana Lens, highlighting 100 photographs from among the many thousands in the collection. Welcome to the show, Mr. John Lawrence. How are you?
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you here. John was a guest, gosh, several years ago. Now you are retired and you have recently released this book. So how are you doing?
I've been doing well. Thank you. The book, which of course is in the Historic New Orleans Collections Publications Catalog, is something that we had talked about probably for most of the last decade in terms of doing, but it seems like my retirement from full-time museum work gave me the opportunity to put it all together, as it were.
Yeah.
And so it became sort of a retirement project, but a very enjoyable one.
Yeah, it's a marvelous book, and we'll certainly get into it. Let's talk a little bit about your career and your history here at the museum, because you've dedicated most of your life to the work here.
It has been an arc of career that I could not have anticipated. The fall of 1975 saw me recently graduated with degrees in literature and art history. I had plans to go to a graduate school and pursue a doctorate in art history, but wanted to work for a year to enable that process to be a little easier. And so I was steered by a number of different people to the Historic New Orleans Collection after I had expressed an interest in trying museum work. Mm-hmm. And over the years, I enjoyed it. It was a very much smaller institution at that time. I believe I was employee number 18, and we're probably pushing about 150 today. Those with the current knowledge of those statistics can confirm or correct that. But I just never found a reason to think that the job was the same. There was always something new to do, not only in terms of how different historical topics were manifested in the collections through different forms of books or photographs or manuscripts. But there was also a physical expansion of the complex over those years that kind of created, for want of a better word, new frontiers for collections and exhibitions. And a designed retirement came at the end of 2020. That brings us up to today.
Yeah. And how did you come to be the sort of curator of the photography archives in particular?
My interest in photography grew from a personal interest in making pictures. Mm. And I think at some point, whether you paint or sculpt or make photographs or write, you want to understand better the context for what it is you're doing and become more cognizant of the history of the medium that has you have chosen or which has chosen you. And so I began to gravitate toward the relatively small number of photographs that were in the collection. And over the years, administrators, you know, could see there was no dislodging me from that interest. And not that there was any effort to do that,
right.
But it ultimately resulted in my being given a title of curator of photographs and being responsible for shaping the growth of those collections and putting them into exhibitions, recommending publications, and those types of things.
And your book, Louisiana Lens, which we're going to get into in quite a bit, is photographs from the collection. But you talk about that the founders of the collection, of the Historic New Orleans collection, really weren't that interested in photographs initially. And so it really sort of took a while and then sort of exploded in its collection, if you will.
Yes. Kemper and Lila Williams, the collection's founders, seemed to have greater interest in more traditional antiquarian type of materials, whether it was maps or rare books or fine prints, paintings. But there were a handful of photographs that had managed to work their way into the collection. It's not always clear to me how all of those came in, but there was something to start with, and fairly soon in my employment here, we were looking at expanding those collections. The chief curator at the time, a woman named Dodie Plateau, was very supportive of that. She had always had a strong interest in contextualizing photographic collections in museums, and in those early years of my career here, she you know, was certainly no small part of any successes that have been laid on my shoulders.
Yeah. And so it went from a very, I'll say, modest collection to quite an expansive collection, which then kind of leads to the book. When you started to do this book and boil it down to 100 pictures or so out of the, I don't know, tens of thousands probably in the collection now, what was the overall goal of the book in your mind? What were you trying to accomplish with it?
The goal of the book had to, at the outset, be one that was selective and, I won't say capricious, but had to address the fact that the uncountable number of photographs that are in the collections could not all be faithfully represented in such a book or really in any book. Mm-hmm. And so the idea was to structure a book that would trace the development of photographic technology as it exists in our collection. And certainly most of the major and a couple of the minor processes are represented by examples in our collection. And also to look at practitioners and events that seemed to answer the question, why is this picture in a history museum? Mm. And so even within that structure, there was a great deal of freedom to look at things. And I don't mean to imply that the selection that is bound between covers is the only selection that could have been made. There were pictures I would have loved to include, and they were not, just for reasons of space and other logistical reasons. But I hope that the narrative about each picture, which is a few to several paragraphs long, can again address that question of why this picture is in a history museum, and that the idea of talking about specific pictures in certain ways, but also in more general ways, is more informative to a general public than an uninterrupted and necessarily incomplete narrative history of photography from 1840 to 2018, which is when this book kind of ends with its picture selection. So I just thought people can look at these pictures, they can read the text, they can kind of fill in their own narrative, they can go online to our holdings and create their own narrative.
Right.
And nothing to me would be a better example of the book's utility if people would do that.
I do find the book very immersive, and it is sort of a coffee table sized book. You know, it's a, I would call it a coffee table book, but what is unique about it is that you have the image, but along with every image, as you pointed out, there's a narrative, sometimes a paragraph, sometimes several paragraphs long. And it strikes me a little bit in the vein of a guest I've had on many times, Richard Campanella. Campanella tries to use geography to go through history. And so you get these two layers. And I think your book very much gives you the layer of, one layer is the actual photograph. Another layer is maybe the context of the photograph. And a third layer is the context or the explanation of the photograph in terms of photography in general, and not so much the actual image that's being portrayed. And I think that's a really dynamic kind of combination you've put together.
Well, thank you. There was certainly a conscious effort to weave all of those things into the narratives. Sometimes the threads are bigger than others in different entries. But the raw material, if you will, of a photograph, that is its immutable characteristics and how you layer your own life experiences, the experiences outside of the frame of what may have been happening at the moment that that picture was made, and just so many other different things that our minds can bring to looking at photographs, associations that may have nothing to do with the content of the picture. And I hope that for whatever value this book has as a sort of baseline or foundational look at photographic practice in Louisiana, it can offer those more individual kinds of applications to every viewer.
Yeah, I think, and you talk about that some in the narrative, both in the introduction and throughout the book, about this kind of multi-lens of looking at the photograph, right? Like it's a photograph and needs to be appreciated for what it was at that moment, and the materials and the lens and the view of that photographer at the moment, but then also through the lens of today.
Yes, the photograph certainly, or I would say mostly, means something different in their present moment than they did at the time that they were photographed, especially if that moment they were photographed is decades, if not centuries old. And the other kind of main theme, I don't know that it's specified so much in any of the text, is that a number of these pictures, and I didn't go through and make a checklist, but a number of these pictures are either in the collections of art museums or by people whose work is collected in art museums as photographic art rather than photographic history or subject matter. And I think that has always been, to me, that's always been something that has been so fascinating about photographs. It's how you look at them, which emphasis you choose to place on them, that makes them so interesting, so changeable, and ultimately how fresh they can remain. It's sort of like renewing, as you sand something with a piece of sandpaper, depending on the sanding material, you're renewing the crystals every time it scratches off something and abrades and renews itself. And I think of photographs is the same way.
It struck me in the book that many of the pictures, I don't want to say timeless, but in a sense, particularly, say, for instance, the Mardi Gras pictures, there's three or four of various parts of Carnival could very easily, I found myself transported to, they could very easily be last year. I mean, certainly you look around in the picture and you see, you know, the age of the buildings or businesses that are no longer there. But you have, for instance, a wonderful image of a riding lieutenant in Rex.
Yes.
And although his clothes are a bit dated, they aren't very different than the riding lieutenants in Rex today.
It's a wonderful picture, and it is by one of those minor processes I mentioned, the autochrome, which was an early somewhat successful color process. And this picture dates from the mid-1920s and has this wonderful cast of dreaminess about it, I guess, for want of a better word. The colors are very muted, but they're there. And the subject is wearing one of those kind of stage curtain face masks that kind of cover the whole lower face. And so you do get this sense of there aren't a whole lot of identifiable clues in there. And as you're saying, this could have been made nearly 100 years ago, or it could have been made 3 years ago.
Depending. Yeah, there's a lot of, I think it's a good example of the photography in the book. And I'm going to ask you about a bunch of them and hopefully not quiz you, but jog your memory on the book. But what struck me about that picture is you don't know if he's already ridden or if he hasn't ridden. It's in a setting very much like if you were going to go to the Rex Den today and photograph in their little museum, it could be very much the same. And so it's immersive in the sense of not only do you have the autochrome and there's a story there and you tell that kind of, again, your book is structured in a way that kind of takes us through the history of photography as well as through the history of Louisiana and New Orleans in particular. But it's a moment in time, not only of Carnival in that particular year, but also autochrome and its use. And it's, I think, a good representation of autochrome in its both limitations and in its glory or its context, right?
Yes. Yes, I think you're right about that. I mean, the autochrome, it was not adapted so much as a professional type of process because its rigidity as a process did not allow for a lot of interpretation. It was pretty locked into those three layers of dyed starch grains and
right.
carbon particles, and there wasn't a whole lot one could do with it beyond make these very elegant pictures. But when it came of age in a time where manipulation of negatives and prints was very much part of an ethos of some aspects of photography, and the autochrome just didn't permit that.
Mm-hmm. And staying with the Mardi Gras theme, kind of in the similar time period, you have this really vivid picture, I believe it's of the Proteus Parade.
Yes.
And again, that's one that could have been taken last year. Obviously, in those parades, those floats are continued to be used, but very vivid, very sharp picture.
It's a wonderful picture. It's one of my favorite Mardi Gras pictures in our entire holdings. It was made by Charles Frank. I want to say 1925. The correct date is in the book.
Right.
And it uses a camera that had widespread use in its day, a panoramic view camera that produced, in this instance, a negative 8 inches tall and 20 inches wide. Mm-hmm. And it is just Charles Frank, a commercial photographer, matching equipment to scene in a way that anyone at any level of photography would be proud to have done.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's at night, being the Proteus Parade, there's specular reflections off of the gold foil on the floats, and I suspect there may have been flash powder or a flash system in place, although it could have been done, it could have achieved that effect with fixed lights, but I don't know what the kind of illumination is.
I was also looking in the picture, I couldn't find it, but I was looking to see flambeau, because that would have provided lighting as well.
Correct, yeah.
But it's a very immersive picture. Like, you look at this picture and you can imagine yourself being right there at the parade.
Right, and the elevated viewpoint, Frank was either standing on his truck or some other platform
right.
because he's above the heads of the crowd. And it really does give it this sort of omniscient view, and while being immersive at the same time, you're not so far. It's not like a view from space, but it's
but you're back a little bit.
You're back, but you're seeing it all,
mm-hmm.
and it really has a great feeling of being at a night parade.
Yeah, and the reason I started with Mardi Gras is because obviously so many people think about Mardi Gras with New Orleans. And again, I think of the 100 pictures, you have maybe four or so of Mardi Gras. But the other part of Mardi Gras that jumped out at me was you have this picture of these guys walking down the street, probably on Mardi Gras Day. I'm going to assume they are probably gay, and that's an assumption on my part, but it looks like part of gay Mardi Gras. They're dressed festively, they have a drink, and again, it's a timeless photograph. I forget when that one is. I think it might be from the 60s, but it
It's by Jack Robinson, if okay. It's the picture I'm thinking of.
It's like probably four guys in the picture,
and,
I think.
And Jack Robinson, there's a wonderful monograph on him that has been published, Sojourn in Paradise, I believe is the subtitle. He was very much a incidental chronicler of certain aspects of gay New Orleans okay. In the 50s and early 1960s. Yeah, it's... you can tell there's a lot of activity on Bourbon Street, yeah. But from my own experiences on Bourbon Street as a teenager, it was much more crowded than that.
Right, right.
So, there are people with long enough memories may see a difference in how they experienced a similar situation.
I just thought the thing that jumped out about me is you had, and the reason I bring up those three photos as a group is in all three instances, they could be images taken today. Sure, you see the dated again of the buildings and the signage changes, but there are three kind of unique aspects on Mardi Gras, which is so vital and such a part of New Orleans. You know, you have this classic kind of picture of Proteus where you're, like you said, just a little bit removed, but also still feel immersive. You have this riding lieutenant, and you have these guys out enjoying Mardi Gras Day. All three of those scenes you could capture next year in 2024 easily.
Right. None of that has gone away.
Right.
In any large sense. Details might change.
And yet you see it in your book through three different styles of photography, three different artists, three different time periods, or two different time periods. And I think that's one of the things that really draws you into the book, at least drew me into the book. Kind of switching topics for you a little bit, we'll go back to one of the very first images in the book, and that's the organ at St. Patrick's.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit and the significance of it?
I think it is significant, and of course, this particular significance could be displaced at any moment, but at the moment of the book's writing, and as far as I know, until now, it represents the earliest photographic image in the historic New Orleans collection. It's a daguerreotype, which was the first photographic process introduced to the city in 1840. And the kind of information that can be put together around this picture suggests that it was around the time the organ was installed in St. Patrick's Church on Camp Street. The newspaper accounts I read gave, a date of April 9th, 1843 as the first playing of that organ. So this is, it's not the first year or two of photography in New Orleans, but it is pretty early. It came to the collection in the archive of the architect James Gallier, who designed for the organ case and the church itself,
right.
Is certainly well established in the city's architectural history. And so whether Gallier himself was skilled in photography, whether someone made this as his request or made it to give to him, it's really hard to tell at this moment. But
yeah,
and I think it shows one of the early uses of photography to record things that in a more or less simple fashion that would have been much more difficult and time consuming to do with other visual media.
Well, and what I love about it as a starting point in the book is that, right, you have the earliest type of photography. You go back to pretty early in the city's history, but you also get a history lesson in terms of you can go down a wormhole about Gallier and all of his work in the city. I knew about his work on St. Patrick's Cathedral. I did not know that he had actually worked on the case for the organ itself as well. And so you can really, again, the book in my mind does a fabulous job of taking you through the sort of history of photography from this earliest type to the modern day and digital photography, while also, again, in a Campanella style, I think, layers in this idea of the history of New Orleans. So you're seeing this picture that's a very significant building, a very significant organ, a very significant part of New Orleans. The architect himself is a very significant part of New Orleans. And all of that is kind of captured on a page and a page of text. And to me, that's really what makes the book so immersive and not just a book you would flip through.
Yes. Well, thank you. It was important for me for the texts accompanying the pictures to try to enlarge the context of every photograph, to give the so-called brittle data about the picture, what it is, who
sure.
made it, when it was, to the degree that those are known, but then to reflect on that in ways that I thought were interesting, but are certainly not the only ways that people can consider the larger world of that photograph, either the world at the time of its making or the world today.
Sure. So I'm going to jump for a minute then to one I was going to get to later. As you say that, it makes me think about this wonderful image in the collection that's in the book of Booker T. Washington.
Yes.
And the picture has him standing, making a speech. There's no podium, so he's dropping his papers on the ground. And there's almost a sense from this collection of papers on the ground of activity. And you talk about what you just said. You talk about this kind of this lens of through today, and you think about all that's going on in the world today, and that a figure like Booker T. Washington could be every bit as much active today as he was in his time. But that picture is just almost frenetic to me. There's a lot of energy, a lot going on there, if you can talk about
that. Yes, it's a portrait, well, kind of an environmental portrait, if you will, of Booker T. Washington by Arthur Badu, who was, in some senses, regarded as an official photographer for Booker T. Washington. Mm. He was with him at Tuskegee. He often traveled with him. And there's another picture by Badu in the book of the band leader Armand Piron that kind of shows a different approach by that photographer to a portrait subject. But Washington, yeah, it's almost like a whistle stop.
Yeah.
Tour. It was, according to the information on the back of the picture, and it looked like it was probably released as some sort of press press photograph, that Badu was making this tour through Louisiana during the last year of his life. And the crowds that he attracted, he's gesturing very forcefully in this picture, very oratorial.
Yeah.
And it's like, boy, wouldn't you have loved to have been there to hear hear the voice, feel the crowd's energy. And the as you mentioned, there was no real podium. It appears that a desk or a table has been upended to serve as a platform for him to rest his hands on. Or, but as you said, the papers are kind of, a lot of them missed their resting spot on the platform, and it does give the picture a lot of energy. And how people want to think of that today, I mean, the idea of someone making a public speech in that way to attract a crowd seems almost contradictory in the days of social media, where, with one short process, you can reach however many followers you have, or however many followers those followers have. And so it's it kind of makes you think about how communication has changed as well.
Yeah, I've been reading separately a lot about the Civil War and about Abraham Lincoln and the Douglas debates and how those served an entertainment as well as an education value. And I thought of that when I saw the Booker T. Washington picture, that you have, certainly he's there to advocate for rights, civil rights, I'm sure. But there is a bit of an entertainment quality in terms of, you didn't have social media. So if you wanted to hear something like that in real time, you had to show up, right? And that image also kind of captures the crowd. The crowd's really close to him.
Yes.
It does bring to mind, you said whistle stop, and that it does feel like that. He could almost be on the caboose of a train, right? But it's an amazing kind of, it's an image I had never seen of New Orleans. And I think, again, it's that the book brings out all these different qualities. We should also talk about, while the book is, it's called Louisiana Lens, it's heavy on pictures from New Orleans, but you have some great pictures that are not New Orleans. You have one by Robert Telfer of the Red River Log Jam.
Yes.
That I had read a lot about the Red River Log Jam, but if you could talk about it a little bit, and it's kind of an amazing picture again in its depth and also the part of history that it's capturing.
Yes, Robert Telfer was a New York-based photographer, and the album from which the pictures that are illustrated in the book are taken was completed 1873-74. Mm-hmm. And there are just over 100 of these 8x10 hand-colored views mounted on specially designed illustrated mounts in this massive album that probably weighs 35 or 40 pounds. But it shows the I guess in some senses, a second clearing of the Red River. The earlier clearing had been done in the 1830s. Henry Miller Shreve, I believe that's the correct middle name for Captain Shreve, had developed a type of catamaran boat that would clear the logjam and make the Red navigable from town of Shreveport down to the confluence with the Atchafalaya. And the nature clogged the stream again. And so 40 years later, the Corps of Engineers is tasked with the same kind of obstacle of making this river navigable. And you look at this and yes, there are like a steam powered kind of lever
or right.
a crane mounted on a barge. But you look at that and you understand that so much of the work was manual and just kind of brute force or animal force in clearing these log jams to in the aid of commerce, of opening up a waterway to Northwest Louisiana, opening it again.
Again, it's a great visual of a historic point in time. And another rabbit hole you can go down to learn all about the log jams and the commerce and opening up the rivers to get, you know, to get further downriver and ultimately the confluence of the Atchafalaya to get to the Mississippi, how important all that was. And there's plenty of books on that topic, but I think in one image, it does capture sort of the visceral, how hard this was to do, because it's an image that, again, kind of gets you thinking about, this is laborious.
Yes. And either Robert Telfer or someone is in his employ, we understand that there are at least three copies of this album, and all of them have the pictures with this mostly restrained hand coloring on them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's... You think of a Corps of Engineers project as being this sort of clinical document.
Right.
But, you know, here is sort of this almost full-blown romantic view of nature with the orange-tinged horizons of sunrise or sunset and clouds and, you know, just the barest hint of vegetation on the landscape. And it makes it pretty special.
Yeah, it really, it brings it to life. And then your narrative next to it really helps add the context to it, which I appreciate. Just a couple more. I wanted to mention, for our listeners in New Orleans will appreciate this, there's this wonderful image of the McFadden Mansion.
Yes.
Which people today, I doubt anyone knows what the McFadden Mansion is until I say that it is the present home of Christian Brothers.
Right.
And then
I spent 4 years there.
Oh, you did? Okay. So maybe that influenced you.
It may have had some influence on this selection. I had a class... In one of my classrooms was in the room pictured in the book.
So if you can talk about that picture a little bit in the context.
Well, I maybe took a little bit more license with the description of that picture, talking about it almost as the setting for a murder mystery or some kind of spooky happening. It's the picture of the den with this sort of very, very weak light coming in through heavily draped windows with, I didn't count how many animal skins there are, animal trophies there are on the walls or on the floor, but it's kind of, you know, has a great sort of Gothic movie or Gothic novel setting something bad about to happen.
Right.
But it's a wonderful picture.
And if you are a New Orleanian and if you're an alum of Christian Brothers, that alone is worth checking out because you can picture what it looks like today and you have this image, which is pretty amazing. And also to kind of think about the context of it's in the middle of City Park in a portion of City Park that's well used for other things. The Children's Museum, for instance, is right nearby now. But it kind of gives you this context. If you take a look at this picture, then the next time you're in the park, you have more of an appreciation other than, oh, this is, I'll say, just a school. There's a whole lot more going on there. And in fact, if you think about the context, the park was already created, and yet there was still this personal ownership there that was later transferred to
the
park.
Right, later annexed to the larger City Park.
So again, I think you do that so well in this book where there are there's this image, but there's also this point in time of history. And almost any of these images, you can go down a rabbit hole and learn a whole lot more, which to me is thrilling, sort of to have, a coffee table style book that really is almost an Alice in Wonderland. You can go down the rabbit hole and almost any of these and study. You find something that interests you and you can really dive deep into it.
Yes, and I think it is a book, although it's structured more or less chronologically, It is because of the episodic nature of the presentation. It's a book to pick up, open in the middle, look at that, or Kind of browse through. And I hope for those who acquire the book that it will be a book that they would enjoy reading more than once addressing more than once. I don't see a whole lot of people starting on page one and going to page whatever the end is,
right.
But to kind of use it as a familiar reference when their mind needs a certain kind of engagement.
Well, I think, for instance, there are some themes that there's sort of, I'll say, Black New Orleans. There's this wonderful picture of Ernie Cato I'd like you to talk about. But I think if you're interested in all of a sudden you're thinking about going to a second line, or you do go to a second line, or you go to what's now the Kermit Ruffin's own mother-in-law lounge, but was owned by Ernie Cato and his wife, you can kind of come back to the book and say, well, let me see what's in the book about this part of New Orleans. And you'll find in that case, three or four examples, whether it's a second line or it's Ernie Cato or a couple different things where you can go back and kind of, as you said, visit the book again and look for those kind of subjects.
Right. It is, New Orleans is too rich in its history for this book to be considered encyclopedic. I hope it's encyclopedic enough.
Yes.
And that whatever lapses it has in the historical timeline will be addressed by future members of our staff.
Right. And I think you hit the big themes, right? But talk for a moment about this just classic picture of Ernie Cato, if you would.
Yes, a portrait of Ernie Cato in his Uncle Sam outfit on the grounds of the mother-in-law lounge, as I recall.
Yeah.
And by Jonathan Traviesa, a New Orleans-based photographer who has done a lot of portraiture. It's not the only type of subject matter that he works with, but Jonathan was, when I talked to him about the picture, he said he recalls it being his first paid assignment.
Oh, wow.
And that he had a certain amount of creativity, but there were some things that I believe the Catos wanted to be included in the picture, but as long as that criteria was met, he had the freedom to make it. And it's just a wonderful picture, and I believe it came into the collection through Ernie Cato's family.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's a great picture, and it captures a moment in time, but it's a moment in time that you could almost duplicate today. I mean, Ernie Cato has been dead for a while, but you could see Kermit Ruffin's doing almost exactly the same thing on that same street corner in front of his bar. As we sort of wind down, because I don't want to touch, we could talk about all 100 photographs, but I want you to buy the book. I want you to check it out. You have a segment where you have some photographs from Katrina. And the one that is most striking to me is from a house on North Muro. And I get asked a lot. I've never done an episode about Katrina, mostly just because I can't get in that headspace to do it. But that photograph, I'll let you describe it, but really in one photograph gives, if you've ever wondered what it was like to come back to New Orleans after Katrina, that photograph captures it, in my opinion.
Yes, I believe the picture you're referring to is by Robert Polidori, who released a very large book of photographs of New Orleans following Katrina called After the Flood. And this picture, it resonated with me for a few different reasons. It did show that destruction that all too many of us witnessed either while it was happening or when we returned. The picture, although it is a color photograph, has that drab, gray-brown coloring that suffused everything.
Yeah.
That's one of my strongest memories of returning to the city, was just this kind of film of dust that
yes.
had been deposited everywhere. And it's a picture inside a person's bedroom. The bed has collapsed. The ceiling has fallen on it. And it, without there being a human figure in it, it gives you the real sense of human loss of not only life, but of memories embodied in material possessions. And it's a very richly symbolic picture, I think.
Yeah.
That is also, on a very basic level, a document. It also reminded me of a similarly conceived picture by Clarence Loughlin done in the 1940s called The Repulsive Bed. I mean, Loughlin's motivations in doing that photograph and staging it were totally different than Polidori's, but the formal similarities are kind of what drew me to that sort of, you know, fleeting art historical connection between the two pictures.
The thing that struck me, you mentioned it a moment ago, when you came back after Katrina, there was a smell in the city, but there was a color or a lack of color. Below the waterline, everything was gray. It was coated in dust, and it was a very, almost as if you had taken film and taken the top part in color and the bottom in black and white. And this picture, although it's a color picture, instantly reminded me of that color, and that kind of everything was coated in a layer of dirt as the water receded. And you also see a bedroom with nice furniture, and the furniture has disintegrated and fallen apart and twisted and torn, and the ceilings on it. And that one photograph does a pretty great job of capturing what tens of thousands of New Orleanians came home to.
Yes.
Despite your status, despite how big your house was, how fancy your furniture was, you opened the door and that's what you found.
Exactly. And I think the Polidori picture offers the opportunity to talk about how the scale of things in the book is not necessarily the scale of things in real life. Polidori makes big pictures.
This picture is like
50 by 60 or something inches.
Right.
And when you are standing in front of that picture, when it's in front of on a wall in front of you, and you get close enough to it, you just don't see anything else. You are in that room.
Right.
And unfortunately, that is something that the book cannot duplicate. But I hope that what is in the book will encourage people to seek out the original objects, whether from this book or other books of photographs or paintings or sculptures that they might enjoy looking at, because it's a very different experience.
Yeah, I mean, and we've only touched on whatever, a handful of the pictures, but each of them in their own way, I think, does sort of draw you in. I think it's achieved that goal that you had, in that you want to learn more about, whether it's Perique tobacco. You have an image that's really great, actually. Perique tobacco is only grown on a very small portion of land in Louisiana. A very specific style of tobacco that's been grown for hundreds of years. You have this great picture. So any of these could just draw you in. Again, the Ernie Cato, the Booker T. Washington, the Mardi Gras images. I think each tells a story, both in terms of, again, back in the context of where we were in photographic development and styles and trends, as well as a slice into Louisiana history at that moment in time. But there's a lot that you could dive into. I think that the picture on North Miro is, well, it obviously you can't get the scope of it in the photograph. It does draw you in and want you to sort of walk into the room almost to observe and to see. Now, I can only imagine seeing the original print and how large it is. It would almost be life size in terms of being able to step into the room.
Yeah, it has a lot of power just as an object.
Yeah. I hope what my goal in this discussion is I want you to buy this book, because I think it's a wonderful representation of New Orleans. It's a wonderful representation of, through your lens on the collection's holdings. I want to mention quickly just a couple of things that are coming up. So this is going to be released this week. We're sitting here on October 17th. It'll be out in a couple of days. On October 28th at the Louisiana Book Festival in Baton Rouge, there's going to be a presentation. There's a book signing there, so you'll be there for that at the Louisiana Book Festival, which is a wonderful event anyway, but a good opportunity to pick up the book and to meet you. On November 9th, you're going to be at one of my favorite bookstores at Octavia Books over there with Tom for a presentation and a signing. Those are always really great, by the way, at Octavia. They do a great job of not just a book signing, but a presentation, an opportunity to interact with the author. author and to hear some behind the scenes, a little bit like what you're getting here, but to hear from people in person. On December 13th, and I'll put all this actually in the show notes, there's a Photo NOLA kickoff presentation, reception, and signing that's here at the collection, at the Historic New Orleans Collection. And then there's a holiday market again at the collection on December 15th where you'll be signing. So you're going to be busy, even though you're retired, helping to promote the book. I'll get from our good friend Dave Walker, who helped set this up, I'll get this information. We'll put it in the show notes so that people can reference it. You can also find a lot of this over on the Historic New Orleans Collection website as well. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much, Mark. Same here. And I hope to see many of your listeners at some of these events and talk to them in person if they're so inclined.
Yeah, this is a book I would highly encourage. We're coming up on the holiday season. If you're looking for something, a token of New Orleans for yourself or for someone who loves New Orleans and Louisiana as a whole, this is a really great book. I get a lot of books sent to me, I have to tell you. This book I did read cover to cover. I read it chronologically, the whole thing. I'm recovering from shoulder surgery, so I had some time. But I do like that you could randomly flip open or leave a page open, and it would be a conversation starter or something that you might drift away and then want to go study more. And that, to me, is just the mark of a fabulous photography book. It's really easy to have a book of just images that capture your eye and then you move on. But the narrative that goes along with each picture, to me, really adds a depth to it. So I just really appreciate it. I'm honored to have the opportunity to talk to you about it and to share this book with our listeners.
Thank you.
So with that, I want to also thank our sponsors, again, the Historic New Orleans Collection, who's also hosting us today, and our friend over at Accidental Cajun Photography, James Cullen. With that, I'm going to turn it over to our daughters to close us out, to my daughters to close us out.
New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with someone else who loves New Orleans as much as you do.
Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.